Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Hi everyone, and welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. This is the show where we speak to key thinkers about their values in order to shape our own thinking about the future of society. I'm Alice Thwaite, I'm the founder and editor of the Echo Chamber Club, and with me today is Julia Hobsbawm. She's the founder of Editorial Intelligence and the first ever professor of networking at London Cass Business School. Her new book, Fully Connected, Surviving and Thriving in an Age of Overload, comes out on the 20th of April in the UK and the 13th of June in the US. And she's here with us today. Welcome, Julia.
Hi, Alice.
Hi. Could we start by perhaps you giving our subscribers and listeners a overview of Fully Connected? What are the key points of the book for you?
Okay, so I have taken as a starting point in the book what's happened over the last 25 years when we've really become surrounded by and embedded in network technology in a way that we really haven't seen before. We're in the middle of what the American social scientists Rainey and Wellman call the triple revolution of social, internet and mobile. And it seems to me that society and however you dip into society, whether you're talking about individuals in their lives or professionals in their lives or policymakers or corporations, society is now entwined and entangled in rather an unhealthy way in this triple revolution. We are completely connected. We are fully connected. But in fact, I wanted to look at connection and its discontents from a sociological perspective, a management perspective, a practical perspective, and possibly even a philosophical perspective. I have studied networks, network science, and applied it to the area that I'm best known for, which is networking. And I think the two are very different. I don't want to sort of dance on the head of a pin in terms of definition, but we are a society that's fully networked. I am absolutely not the first person to make this observation. And yet I think that we have reached a very profound pivot moment in that networkedness. What I mean is that for about 150 years, society has lived lives on network technology, the railroads, using the car and so on, and obviously the telephone, the underground telegraph cables being laid in 1857. What I think has shifted in this last 25-year or so period since the internet and since the advent of social and mobile is that we've not just begun to lead lives embedded on and in networks, but we've begun to behave as if we are networks. And I think that the technology companies deliberately and unconsciously and for entirely commercially driven reasons, have propelled us into a psychological state where we believe that we are technology and we're not, we're humans. And so I'm trying to explore the complexity of that. I'm trying to look at the politics of connection and its equal and opposite, which is disconnection. So quite a broad range of looking at connectedness, which is why the book's called Fully Connected.
That's a fantastic overview of a very comprehensive book as well, I will say. Throughout it, though, you do talk about the notion of social health and social health you talk about it, it's a metaphor. I don't suppose Yes. You could just go into a bit more detail about what health means to you, especially because you've just said that psychologically humans have started to think of themselves as machines. How do you join together health with future automation and the way that we're going to start interacting with machines in the future?
So the book does take as a metaphor and almost a leitmotif running through it, not just the concept of what does modern connectedness mean, but the idea that modern connectedness has lots of things that are unhealthy. And I took as a starting position the original definition of health created by the World Health Organization in 1946. It was, of course, a subset, still is, of the UN. And it interested me that 70 years ago, lots of the supranational bodies which are now creaking at the seams, the world was created post-war 70 years ago with lots and lots of institutions, including the World Health Organization, where, if you like, the definitions have not necessarily had a fresh look or indeed an update. And the original definition of health in 1946, actually enacted in 1948, which is still here today, is that good health is not merely the absence of injury and disease, but the presence of physical, mental, and social well-being. And I was really struck by that for two reasons. One is that obviously social well-being, as prescribed in 1946, was utterly different to what it means today, because there was no social media. It meant class. It meant social systems, which, you know, we still need to factor in hugely, but it didn't in any way reference the social world of the networked society. The other thing that struck me about that original definition of health was that, in fact, despite our awareness of, you know, the disaster of smoking and the obesity epidemic, which is largely, by the way, I think an accident of a combination of the sugar industry, the car industry, and the television. Despite what we regard as bad health in society, society has never been healthier in many respects. The advances in medicine are one thing, but also our behaviours. So, for instance, our literacy and awareness of physical and mental well-being is extremely high. You could pretty much stop anyone on the street and ask them what the difference is between a carb and a calorie and a protein and a high-intensity workout, and they would almost certainly be able to tell you, is first thing. The second thing is just the economics of it, which is a slightly startling figure that I rechecked several times in order to believe it, is that the global wellness business, that is not medicine, but it's sort of everything else to do with wellness, from fitness gear to vitamins to spas to gyms to mindfulness books and apps, that entire business is worth nearly twice the arms trade. It's many, many trillions. And so, in some senses, it made me realize that society does change its attitudes and behaviors, but it needs to notice those attitudes and behaviors that need changing. And in the case of actual physical health in particular, post-war 1946, you had citizens ravaged by two world wars. You have the great flu epidemic after the First World War, which was index-linked to social and physical health factors, as well as transport factors. And so it made me think, hang on a minute, if we start from the position that modern connectedness has many aspects that are unhealthy, if we start from a position of looking at this pivot moment as one in which change can happen, if we start from the perspective of looking at health and healthiness, then we might get somewhere. And then I began to look at health itself. And I began to look in two particular areas. One was the network effects of disease. So my specialty is studying connectedness and studying network science and how that can apply to what I would call behavioral networks, how people actually operate behaviorally when they are connected. So that's everything from how they operate on Facebook. Some Americans spend up to 50 minutes a day on Facebook. 13% of Britons are on Instagram, for example. To how we behave in small social groups, the politics of isolation and social capital and what have you. And I began to look at that question of networked behavior, wherever it comes, And you see it very, very clearly in Hell. So the book opens with the story of the Ebola crisis of 2014, which is both a story of extraordinary clarity when you look at connectedness in terms of the spread of infectious disease. But it also, it turned out, rather fascinatingly, was an object lesson in the politics of bad connectedness, bad joined upness. The World Health Organization itself was subject to one of its most substantial failures ever, which is it was incredibly slow to respond to the warning signs heeded by the smaller, more agile Médecins Sans Frontières, who were saying, hey, there's a massive problem here. You know, this particular outbreak is close to cities. It could spread. It could jump. It's behaving in an extremely virulent way. And the World Health Organization just did not get its act together. And 11,000 people died in a very short period of time in six different nations. So part of that was the politics of connectedness. And part of it was the network properties of a disease itself. So at that point, I really felt that the concept of healthy behavior and therefore of social health needed an update. And so my book is partly a prescription for what is social health. And I'll give you my definition of social health in long and short form, if you'd like, Alice. I'm going to give you both, actually, because the longer one is not that long. Social health means balancing face-to-face and electronic connections in a way that manages flows of knowledge, networks, and time. Those with good social health know who and what to connect with, as well as the value of disconnection. Social health is a mindset and a behavior that applies equally to individuals and organizations. But the Twitter version is social health is who, what, and when you know. Those with social health balance face-to-face and technology and know where to find the off switch. In the case of West Africa in 2014, the off switch was flipped by the only African leader who's a woman, President Eileen Sirleaf Johnson of Liberia, and she imposed a quarantine. This was a very politically sensitive, questionable gesture, but it worked. And so one of the things that interests me is to carry on that health metaphor of when do you have to cut off and cut out from something rather than when do you have to just continue the spiraling effect of connectedness.
I have to say that that was one of the main takeaways of the book for me, was about redefining what health means and about not thinking about health as something that an individual looks after, but also really encompasses societies. You know, you've spoken about public services, but we do use the word the health of public service, but I'd never really thought about it as being so connected to the health of myself. So I thought that was, it's really well done. But I did also want to speak a little bit about you, because you have said in interviews in the past that you're not interested in politics, but you're interested in social change. Health is obviously a big political agenda for a lot of governments. It's in the news a lot at the moment. Where would you say your values come from when health is involved? How would you characterize your values, basically?
Yes, I mean, I wouldn't say I have values that pertain to health rather than overall values. I would say my values are broad and probably politically plural, diverse, or polygamous even. I'm not attached to any one political party. And in fact, I really don't like tribal politics. I don't much like party politics. I can see the organisational managerial requirement for political parties to exist, but I don't think they function, and functionality and management is absolutely a core part of what I believe is healthy behavior. I think there's a lot of dysfunction, you know, the physical and health metaphors do extend into politics. My own values are shaped partly by my family background. My late father was a Marxist historian, rather celebrated in his field. we had sort of half of the Euro-communism traipsing through our house at various points during my childhood. So I was exposed to a lot of, literary figures, political figures. But the truth is, my own politics and values are this: I'm interested in things being done properly and well, and with a mixture of intuition and common sense. One of the things that I think was, very disappointing about the David Cameron government, which in its early days I had quite a lot of time for, was things like the bedroom tax. I just thought it was incompetent. I think that in an era in which you can walk into an Apple store and have a cheerful person walk up to you in a t-shirt and take your payment from an object dangling around their neck, the idea that people with disabilities and illnesses are having to suffer while, bureaucrats using cumbersome old algorithms are calculating their need instead of actually witnessing what their need is and dealing with them in a point of sale way, which is a very modern way, I thought was really disgraceful. And I think that part of the problem of politics is it doesn't know how to behave entrepreneurially. It doesn't know how to just do things with agility. We're back, if you like, to the analogy with the World Health Organization. In a networked world, you can't operate in silos effectively. You can't operate in hierarchies effectively. So in a sense, my politics are less about left and right and more about what I believe is getting things done. That is what interests me. I'm rather a pragmatist at heart. I'm a bit of a management organizational behavior nerd, and I like things being done well and efficiently. In fact, if I had all the time in the world, I would set up a sort of public-private coalition called D for Deliver, aimed at supporting public services using a private sector mindset. Because I think, and I write a lot about this in the book, as you know, that one area where you see huge political dysfunction and mismanagement with disastrous human consequences is in the social services.
I was when you were talking, I was wondering if this is a new form of pragmatism, and it's almost like a humane pragmatism, because I think when a lot of people think about pragmatism, they think of something that's quite robotic and efficient, whereas this seems to be something slightly different that you're describing right now.
So what I write about in the book is a prescription for social health, and it includes a sort of 6-point plan, if you like, 6 ingredients by which I believe institutions, individuals might achieve and attain and keep going with social health. The 3 core ingredients, which I talked about earlier, are being able to manage and harness the ratios of your information flows and knowledge. Part of this revolution, triple revolution I talked about earlier, has been that we are drowning in information overload. We are literally engulfed. It's probably a longer conversation for another day, but the whole question of fake news has arisen, I believe, directly and explicitly out of this social revolution, that we've simply had too much information now and everybody's tuning out. Everybody wants the most reductive, almost silly version of truth, because they just can't dig around to find the real stuff. There's no curation or navigation, or there is, but with great exception. So information overload, knowledge excess, being able to manage your knowledge is critical. Networks, obviously, we need to find the balance between who we connect with on and offline. And you won't be surprised that I believe that the proportions in which we network online need to be completely reversed. We need to do far less on social media and far more face-to-face. And the third core ingredient to successful social health, if you like, in the same way that one thinks of physical health as, I don't know, sleep, exercise, nutrition, is time, which is we have an extreme time poverty. Most people do not even know that the number 168 is probably the most important number that applies to them in their lives, and it's the finite number of hours end to end in the week. It's a very small number, but the current culture that we live in exhorts us to live in huge multiple digit realities, which are, of course, false. So knowledge, networks and time are the three core ingredients to balancing and managing social health. But there are also three complementary, what I would call coping mechanisms in order to achieving that. One is process and management. Note, I do not say leadership. It's another conversation for another day, but I think we've overinvested in the concept of leadership rather than the concept of process and management, which is a much more egalitarian, community-based concept than leadership, which is beginning to feel to me slightly dated, and it's clearly not working. If leadership were working, why is global productivity languishing at 1.2%? So management and process is important. Communication is vital, obviously, being understood, being misunderstood, all of that. But the final ingredient to social health, which brings me back to your point about the public realm, is the exact opposite of what a bean counter charting someone's eligibility for disability benefit is we need to have sixth sense. We need to have instinct. We need to have a reconnection, even in the workplace, especially in the workplace, to the idea of what's really necessary and what really works and doesn't work. And until and unless we have that, we will not be a just society. We will not be an equal society, and we won't be a functional one.
So, yeah, I think what you're putting forward is an incredibly different form of how we approach society and perhaps how we approach politics. And it's something that I'd like to hear more about in due course, actually, and wonder if other people expand upon the points that you've just raised. It would also be good to hear from our listeners about whether or not they agree with some of the things that you said, or whether or not it's made them think slightly differently. But to, as you know, Julia, our podcast is just one facet of what we do. We also have a newsletter that challenges our listeners and subscribers to think outside the box. I usually ask about books and podcasts, but given that you have a fantastic network, I'd quite like to ask you about the people that you think are pushing boundaries right now and who are challenging the status quo. Who are the people that we should be looking out for?
Well, I'm just in the middle of reading Anne-Marie Slaughter's new book, The Chessboard and the Web, about the networked world in foreign policy in particular. And there's quite a lot of overlap and complementarity with my book, Fully Connected. I think she's a very, very interesting thinker. Both she and I are huge fans of Jeff Mulgan of Nesta, and cite him in our respective books. Jeff Mulgan was probably one of the earliest proponents of behaving in a networked way. And he wrote a book in 1997 called Connexity. I am very influenced by the management and organizational behavior and network writers and academics such as Herminia Ibarra of INSEAD and London Business School, and Linda Grattan of London Business School. I read a lot of aggregated, curated reads. As you know, I run a knowledge networking company called Editorial Intelligence. We produce our own free morning EI digest of the UK comment media, which has grown fairly substantially in circulation in these times when people do, I believe, want curated, guided knowledge. And I read a lot of those kind of newsletters myself. I love Brain Pickings, for example, Maria Popova's selection. I do also take a lot of inspiration from fiction and from literature. I was very pleased that, in addition to getting the rights to quote Marshall McLuhan in Fully Connected, I also secured the rights to quote Iris Murdoch and Elena Ferrante, respectively. I think that what we learn from the cultural sphere is very important. So a lot of my thinking is often influenced by what I'm reading in fiction. So I think that one of the key things that people need to reframe their thinking about is that networked living, networking, is not just about who you are connected to and who you know. It's really about what you know and what you share and who you trust to give you that pathway to a piece of information or an idea that you haven't thought of before. So at quite a granular level, I think our behaviours need to subtly shift in exactly the way they have done around our physical and our mental well-being.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Julia. It's been a great interview.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Julia for coming to speak with me about a pragmatic vision for a healthier society. So just how many of you are pragmatists? Does what Julia said echo with your own values about managing society and politics? Email me with your thoughts. I'm at editor@echochamber.club. And speaking of which, I had some comments after the recent podcast with Matthew D'Ancona. Joe wrote in to say, automation is exactly the sort of problem that politicians should be dealing with, and wonders how best to communicate this issue. Barbara emailed to say that pluralism may agree on a set of non-negotiable rules, but sometimes these aren't upheld. She gave the example of equality of opportunity here. Keep your ideas coming, and very much hope to have you with us again for the next podcast. Take care.